Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science, and health politics in the news. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. In just a moment, I'll be giving out the numbers and taking your calls. I also have some interesting emails we got this week. But I have to do a commentary, because the blow-by-blow discussion and the prominence on the front pages of the newspapers and as lead stories in the news this week, as well as, God knows, I'm sure the blogosphere is just popping with healthcare reform and the blow-by-blow discussion of the congressional negotiations and deal-making. It brings to mind the adage about there's two things you should never watch being made, law or sausages, because the ingredients will put you off the final product. And certainly, I get that feeling. But another thing happened this week, and that is that I was, via, I believe, Terry Gross's show, turned on to an article that appeared in the June 1st New Yorker magazine by Atul Gawande about healthcare costs. And this is a really good article and well thought out, and I certainly recommend it to everyone. As I reviewed it, I saw reasons for optimism, and I want to take a few moments to talk about that. First of all, the New Yorker article basically is written by a surgeon and a journalist who went to McAllen, Texas, and Grand Junction, Colorado, and the Mayo Clinic, and a few other places. He was following the outliers. So he was looking at national statistics for areas where the most money was spent by Medicare and Medicaid, and the least. And he was also looking at the area that had the most money and below the average quality of care, and the place that's had the least money and above the average quality of care. And so using those kinds of selection criteria, he went after what are the differences between the places. And the article is about those differences, and I certainly would recommend it. The lesson that I took from this article is that outliers exist in both directions, both in the low-cost, high-quality direction and in the high-cost, low-quality direction. And so we need to approach our particular situation in healthcare by viewing our country with, and this is a good thing about competition, is that we have a laboratory. No, we have thousands of laboratories and communities all over the country, and these laboratories are real medical ecosystems. We all know the inputs of the system. We have payers, Medicare and health insurance. We have the hospitals, we have the doctors, and we have the patients. And knowing those, we can make predictions about how that system might run. In the article, Gawande talks about McAllen, Texas, which runs pretty much purely off of the existing incentives. The incentives as they are generate the McAllen ecosystem. And then he looks at the Mayo Clinic, which is the opposite. It's a high quality, low cost place. And there, they've tweaked the incentives. They've achieved that by essentially a communal redistribution of resources. Mayo Clinic is doing socialized medicine within its walls. The doctors basically share in the collective resources of the clinic in such a way that there's an emphasis for stewardship. In other words, let's be as efficient as possible. Let's do a really good high-quality job, but let's not spend any more money getting to those results than we have to. And that's a good idea, actually, because for every unnecessary test, let's say we do 100,000 unnecessary endoscopies. Of those, maybe 1 in 10,000, there's going to be a perforation of the intestine. And that person's going to be hospitalized for 2 weeks or maybe even die. So what does that amount to? That's 100 people who end up in the hospital that shouldn't. So why did we do those unnecessary endoscopies? And that's one of the questions we need to be asking. What I found even more interesting was the discussion of Grand Junction, Colorado, because that's not a single clinic within a walls. That's a bunch of independent doctors' offices, an IPA, an Independent Physicians Association. And the setup there in Grand Junction very much resembles the setup here in my community here in Santa Cruz County. So I was very intrigued at what I could glean from that analysis. Let's bring it home to my home here in Santa Cruz County. And what I come away with is, as we start looking at medical ecosystems, we have to really look very carefully at competition. For the most part, competition is bad. The market argument, oh, well, it involves making people happier, it gets people to work harder. It's true up to a point, but competition for income is bad because it does generate cherry picking, which is to say, you look for the healthiest, best insured patients, and we have a little bit of that going on in our community. We have alignment of incentives to do more procedures, and you don't get paid for doing less in our community. Really, there's no way to share back, to feed back the improvements. Like if you do better quality and spend less money, you're just going to get paid less, and there really isn't a way for quality to be awarded. They're trying just by doing things like what percentage of your patients have mammograms, but that really doesn't get at true quality. The other thing I think that still drives doctors too much is fear of malpractice. And here's where I think the government, whether or not we end up with just a patch on our current system that covers the uninsured but really doesn't get to the siphoning off of profits by the insurance companies, this is something the government could do that would be very beneficial to the system. And that's provide some national standards of care. Because if you're in McAllen, Texas, the local standard of care is a woman with chest pain who's 40 years old and just had a fight with her husband will not just get an EKG and a stress test, she'll probably end up getting a cardiac catheterization, which is completely disproportionate and puts her at risk of complications unnecessarily. But if that's local standard of care, you could be sued for not doing it. Not that you will be, but that you could be, is enough to motivate doctors' behavior. So why take less money and take a big risk to take less money? That's not something that doctors will do unless there is a broad amount of charismatic local leadership. And that's asking a lot. However, if you have a government standard for what represents the appropriate intervention, the I can't be sued if I do this kind of standards, and these can be established scientifically and through national consensus. There's no reason for us not to have these. And this is one of the things that I brought out of this New Yorker article, and I urge you to look it up. It's the June 1st New Yorker. I was able to find it online very easily, and the author is Gawande, G-A-W-A-N-D-E. Let's go now to Virginia in Boulder Creek. Hello, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. John.
Hi.
I don't know if you've seen the local paper that had a flyer come out this week on screening procedure for carotid artery, aortic aneurysm, arterial disease, the peripheral arterial disease.
Oh, Virginia, not only did I see it, but I turned 51 a couple of weeks ago, so now I get my AARP literature, and I get three or four mailings from this company now, about one a quarter. So I've reviewed their literature extensively, and I am so glad that Peggy Fleming is okay. But I look at this, and this is just a beautiful example of what's wrong with our system.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you could comment on it.
Yeah. Well, I also had an email from Geraldine in Watsonville asking pretty much the same question. Just by the by, Geraldine, I recommend that everybody get Pneumovax after 65, even if you're healthy, because a bad case of pneumonia after 65 is much more likely to be lethal. This is strep pneumonia. Now, back to Virginia and your question.
Uh-huh.
When you look at each of the procedures that are down there, you've got an abdominal aortic aneurysm. So that's the abdominal ultrasound. So let's talk about that. Who should get that? Basically, men over 50 who have ever smoked have enough of a risk statistically of an abdominal aneurysm that it's worth looking for.
How about if your mother had one and you're a female?
It's not clear whether or not it's statistically a high enough risk to justify the additional cost, but we don't have to worry about that. We could just say, for the sake of argument, that if you have a family member who had a triple A, there's a possibility that you might have inherited the tendency. So yeah, go ahead and have one. The other risk factors, smoking and hypertension, need to be alluded to, because those are both important risk factors. And if you look at the risk of a ruptured aortic aneurysm, this is one of those stealth conditions that can sneak up on you. So I think that you could justify. Now, they also screen you for peripheral artery disease, which is blockage in your legs and feet. That one is, you know, that's nail polish, basically, because you're going to know if you have that problem. You will have symptoms, and we wouldn't do anything about it if you didn't. We're not going to treat that disorder unless it's symptomatic. And the two symptoms that are possible are, number one, if you have a cramping in your leg after walking a certain distance that's reproducible and it goes away with rest, that would be one symptom. And the other would be a sore or an ulcer on the foot or leg that didn't heal. And both of those are going to send you to the doctor anyway. And since we wouldn't treat you until you had one or the other of those, that one doesn't make any sense. That's just, you know, like I said, that's just a nail polish. It makes it seem like you're getting a lot because it's, you know, it's $139.
I recently had a carotid artery screening, which cost me roughly six times that at Dominican.
Right. Well, the problem with the carotid artery screening that comes from Lifeline is if you get that, I'm going to have to get another one at Dominican anyway. Because they don't give me the data I need to make a clinical judgment. They give me a yes, no. So, yes, there's plaque. Okay, well, thank you very much. How much is it? How thick is it? Where is it? And is it flow limiting? Because I'm not, again, going to treat plaque unless it's flow limiting or causing symptoms.
Perfect. You've answered my question.
Good. The thing is, these are all justifiable, but they lack the clinical context. And so, and the people that they're marketing to are people who've already had their cholesterol checked. Mm-hmm. So you could make an argument that Lifeline might be doing this type of screening, might be doing a good thing, except that the people who have the $130 to pay them are not the people who are out there with undiagnosed hyperlipidemia and no access to medical care.
Right.
So we're not getting the population that this type of screening could be justified in. Instead, it's being marketed as a secondary benefit. It's basically being marketed as a security blanket, which is what a lot of this stuff is. First, you make people afraid by, you know, by the lovely package literature about, you know, we didn't know that my husband had an aneurysm and it saved, maybe it saved his life, but odds are most people with aortic aneurysms don't rupture. But once you find that you have one, well, then you're worried that you're going to rupture every day for the rest of your life. Screening is not always such a great idea. Certainly, this type of program and the way it's marketing does nothing to reduce healthcare costs. It makes a tidy profit for the company. The way they do the reports, they protect themselves from liability because, like I said, they find something. I then have to go out and do the real test that gives me the information I need to make a clinical decision.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Doreen in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doreen, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I don't really have a problem. I just have a question. I'm 76 years old, and I'm in optimum health, and I get plenty of exercise, and I never eat junk food and so on and so forth. However, my body has changed its shape, which is normal, I guess, but I would like to be able to lose a bunch of weight, about 20 pounds, and I can't seem to do it with the regular things that have sustained me most of my life. And I wondered if you knew anything about this new Brazilian berry that I see so much advertising, but I don't trust advertising, and I'm not going to take it unless I can find out if it's harmful, especially at my age.
What's the name of the berry?
I don't know how to pronounce it. It's A-C-A-I.
Okay, I do know about that. And what that berry is, and I believe it's pronounced acai, but I'm not 100% sure myself. I'm sure someone will call in and correct me if I don't have it right, which is fine. What this is it's an antioxidant, and it's really got good legs as having lots of antioxidant potential in it. And there's a way that that's calculated scientifically, and I forget the term, but it's a good antioxidant. It can not really be assumed to be a great weight loss drug. And I'm not so sure that a drug or an herb is really what you need. Now, you said that you are experiencing weight gain that you've not been able to lose. Is this weight gain around your middle?
Yes.
Okay. Then let me tell you a little bit about how fat around your middle is different from the fat around your thighs and your butt that you got maybe during your pregnancies. When we gain weight on the limbs, it has different biochemical properties. Weight that you gain around the middle actually secretes, it's actually an endocrine tissue, that visceral fat, we call it visceral adipose tissue, mm-hmm. and it secretes 17 different hormones, most of them bad for you. Most of them act to increase your appetite and decrease your insulin responsiveness, which causes your body to excrete more insulin, which causes you to have more hunger, which causes you to eat more, which causes the adipose tissue in your belly to grow. And so it's a vicious circle. It's almost like a parasite in terms of how it makes your body behave. And it does it through the means of hormones. So the first thing that I always recommend to people who are experiencing this is they really need to go on a diet that severely limits simple carbohydrates. And this would be stuff like bread, even whole grain bread, pasta, even whole grain pasta, and switching over to vegetables. There have been a number of very good books that provide different versions of this. The most controversial one is Atkins, because they basically say you're going to eat fat and you're going to eat protein and that's it. No carbohydrates at all. And while that works, I believe that that's too extreme a diet. And also in seniors, because they aren't all that good at grabbing vitamins from vitamin pills or vitamin supplements because their intestines don't work as efficiently, I think it's dangerous and will induce micronutrient deficiencies. So Atkins for an 18-year-old who wants to take off 10 pounds over the summer, great idea, but just be sure that you start eating vegetables after you've pulled the weight off. South Beach diet is one version. The Spectrum diet, which is a Dean Ornish diet, is another version. There are other versions of this out there. The Paleo diet is another one that you may have seen. I like the Paleo diet because it's kind of a fun read. He basically frames it as, if it's not something that a caveman had access to, don't eat it. It's interesting to kind of walk through, go to a restaurant or walk through a store and realize, well, you can't have milled flour as a caveman. You know, you might arguably be able to have really crude cornmeal or something, but you're not going to have baked goods. And that's really what it boils down to. Before agriculture, the diet was different. That's the diet we are most adapted for. And it's the diet that really discourages visceral adipose tissue. And it tends to be a higher protein diet. So in your 70s, you're going to need to be sure you get adequate fluids. And we need to know that you have good kidney function before you embark on such a weight loss program. But
well, I already know that. I'm in top health. I don't take any medications at all. I don't take...
Antioxidants are wonderful. They help prevent cancer. You've probably, at the age of 70, despite living in a very healthy way, you know, you've walked around on the planet, which means that you've encountered oxidative stresses, cosmic rays, and you probably have mutated cells in your body that are precancerous and being held at bay by your immune system. Doesn't hurt to keep the mutation rate down by using lots of antioxidants.
Well, what's the name of that diet? So you don't think I should take anything like this, acai berry?
I don't think you should consider it as a weight loss drug. If you want to use it for its antioxidant purposes, I think that's fine. But it's the mangosteen people and the acai people and the goji people, and everybody is just marketing the heck out of this now.
Yeah, I know.
But all you really need, you live in paradise. You know, go down to the farmer's market once a week.
Well, I work in paradise.
Yeah.
That's, I work in the park system.
Well, go to the farmer's market every week and stock up on fresh vegetables and make that and lean protein the mainstay of your diet, and stay away from all breads and pastas, noodles, rice, for a month. And don't do anything else. Don't calorie count, don't portion count. Just, you know, when you want to have spaghetti squash. And when you want to have guacamole, use cucumber chips. And just do that for a month.
Okay.
Okay? Yes. The books are The South Beach Diet, The Paleo Diet, and The Spectrum.
I've never done any of those because I've never had a problem before.
I know, but I'm just saying, you said what books, so I'm answering your question. Good luck to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Call us back and let us know how it went.
Okay, I will.
All right.
Thank you.
It's a great month to do it, folks. I was just at the farmer's market yesterday, and the produce was so fresh that there were little beads of sap on the stems of the zucchini. You can't get any fresher than that. Let's go to Leroy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Leroy. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I heard you talk about Botin for fingernails. I got some really bad brittle fingernails.
Biotin, B-I-O-T-I-N.
I got to write that down. I got some of it over in Napa. It's B-I-O-T-I-N.
Biotin is one of the B vitamins. You could get biotin separately, but I recommend doing it as part of a B complex because there are levels. You could get your urine biotin checked if you wanted to know whether you were deficient and that was your problem. Biotin supplements are good. Something a lot of people don't know is brewer's yeast, which is something people used to take as a health food, is actually an excellent B vitamin. It contains all the B vitamins in appropriate ratios to each other.
Oh, brewer's yeast.
Brewer's yeast. Yeah.
Good. I'll try some brewer's yeast. That sounds like a great idea.
I really like trying to get things in as food whenever possible. We grew up on this planet, and so the ratios of nutrients that are available in the food are safety tested by Mother Nature, if you know what I mean. We grew up eating those foods, so we are adapted to those ratios. And then when we get all scientific and start extracting things and making new ratios, putting in like lots of biotin and nothing else, we're experimenting on ourselves at that point. And, well, you know, why do that if you don't have to?
That's so true. Hey, can I ask one more question about my lips? I have a tendency to get those cold sores. Now, I have the dry in the corners of my mouth. I'm getting like these dry. So I got some Abreva. Seems to be working okay. It always takes a long time to get it to go away.
You sound like you have some micronutrient deficiencies because both deficiencies of zinc and vitamin A can cause that chelitis. It's called a little cracking at the edges of the mouth.
Okay.
And so it seems to me that what you really need is a high-quality multivitamin because you may be having some problems with absorption.
Cut mine in half. I saw this thing, and I started cutting my everyday vitamin in half. I hope that maybe that's why. I don't know.
Well, I suspect that you maybe need to get a vitamin that's a little bit less compacted. I read an interesting study about it 6 months ago, and it really changed my attitude about vitamins because it was describing the industrial processing that your, you know, one a day or your Centrum goes through to get all of those nutrients squeezed down into one little pill.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of like what starts out as vitamin C and what starts out as vitamin D, which are shapes, you know, they're molecules that have a certain shape. They kind of get squeezed and compacted, and they may not be as valuable or as absorbable by your system when they come in a compacted form as when you take them as a powder or as some of the vitamin packets you see where it seems like you're taking six pills. You look at the milligrams and it's the same as the Centrum. So it seems like, well, heck, I should just take the Centrum. But there's a difference in terms of its bioavailability that's actually quite marked.
Oh, well, yeah, Trader Joe's has those little packets. Maybe I'll get some of those.
Those might be a better choice.
Yeah. One more thing before I go, I got chronic pain. I'm like 60 and I'm getting older, but I got three or four problems. I got the bad discs in my lower back, and I got a botched operation on my groin, and I got a shattered knee and a shattered ankle.
Oh, so Lord.
I get these headaches from the pain sometimes, and so all the pains kind of attack me at once sometimes. And anyway, I'm taking this stuff called oxycodone and hydrocodone.
Right.
But I only got them because I had some teeth. And I try to stay away from the pharmaceuticals, but it's so easy to fall in love with them because they take the edge off of the pain.
So I got the background. What's the question?
Is there anything I can do? Because I'm going to be running out of these pills real quick anyway.
Yeah, okay. First of all, you need to develop a relationship with a primary care physician and establish a contract, essentially, for your pain meds and start looking for ways to, you know, physical therapy, pool aerobics, ways that will naturally reduce your pain. Things that are natural and helpful for pain would be turmeric or curcuminoids. Zyflamind is a brand name of that product that you can find. Also, high doses of omega-3 fatty acids, which are fish oil, have an anti-inflammatory property, and that will help with your pain drivers, that and gentle activity and stretching. So you've got some work cut out for you there. It's a complex topic and really not a question we can take, especially with other callers waiting. But I want to urge you to, if you can, you can come and see me over at my Mission Street office. If you can't, then keep calling and call with one question at a time, okay? And we'll chip away at it.
Lost all my ability to see doctors, so I listen to your program anyway. But I
all right. So call in next week, and we'll chip away problem
much.
By problem. Bye bye.
Very much.
Let's go to Beth in Felton. Hello, Beth, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thank
Hi.
You for taking my call. I have a 25-year-old son who was diagnosed about 3 years ago with Marfan syndrome, and he physically certainly fits the type. He was diagnosed in the military, and they didn't. There's four body systems that can be affected, and they didn't check all of his body systems that could be affected. He does have scoliosis that then it was about 20%, and he has pectus excavans. But they didn't, at that time, they did check his eyes, but they didn't do, it was just a quick check. They didn't examine his heart, and they also didn't do any check on his, I guess it would be his lungs. And I haven't been able to find any literature online regarding if pectus excavatum and scoliosis can occur without Marfan's.
Okay. Well, Marfan's disease, first of all, can be diagnosed definitively with genetic testing. Do you know if he had the genetic testing?
No.
All right.
That's probably the easiest way to go.
At this point, you don't tell someone, oh, you've got Marfan's just because they have scoliosis. There are physical findings, like, for example, the distance from fingertip from your right fingertip to your left fingertip is longer than your height. That's one indication. Long, skinny fingers. And then the pushed-in pectus excavatum can occur in other conditions, but it's very common in Marfan's. The roof of the mouth is often arched up, and that's a flashlight test. And the big concern is the aorta.
Right.
The aorta develops an aneurysm. And the thing about the aortic aneurysms is they typically don't hit you until your 30s or 40s. In Marfan's. So a lot of doctors say that Abraham Lincoln had Marfan mm-hmm. syndrome based on his physical appearance. And many people have said kind of wryly that he was just about the age when his aneurysm would have let go by the numbers when he was killed. And so he may have been fated to die young regardless of the assassin's bullet. We can, in people with Marfan syndrome, monitor them. And of course, you want to keep the blood pressures low. And we've tried fixing the aorta, but the problem is that's such a dangerous surgery that we really haven't been able to extend the lifespan of people with Marfan's. Mm-hmm. Most people do live to be about 60, mm-hmm. and the main thing is controlling the blood pressure.
Right.
That's key, because the higher the blood pressure, the more likely that hose, the aorta, is to stretch out. And as far as the lens is concerned, yeah, that is a cursory examination, because if the lens is there, it's there.
Right.
If it's dropped, the person's going to experience a visual change, and we're going to put the lens back up in place.
Right.
But if he has Marfan's, he's going to need different healthcare surveillance and to have a different kind of threshold for activity and action.
Right.
So his doctors really do need to know that going forward. The problem with genetic testing right now, and unfortunately, until I see the legislation, I would not get that genetic test, because whatever comes out of Washington this summer and gets passed, hopefully, and signed in October, will either have a non-discrimination clause for people with genetic diseases,
right.
or it won't. And that depends on how powerful the insurance lobby manages to be and how intelligent the Senate and the Congress are about this, because if they let it through without that kind of a guarantee, then one of the greatest injustices of our country, which is this pre-existing condition insurance leper situation, will have not been addressed. Like I said, I'm optimistic that we will get coverage for people who can't get coverage, and that's a lot of that 40 million people, 50 million now, are people with Marfan's or something even more dangerous like asthma. And it's ridiculous, but that's our situation. We need to fix that. As far as your son's concerned, though, I wouldn't go on record. He's got the Marfan's thing from the Army, which will be searchable in medical record, but the genetic testing is definitive.
Okay.
And so you can just say, well, it's just scoliosis. It's not for sure Marfan's.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome. Have a good day, and good luck to you and your son.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, I just reminded myself that I wanted to mention two reports that came out this week. Actually, three reports that came out this week. Just little heads up kind of health in the news that you can use, and they're quick. One of them is the chocolate chip cookie dough. The Toll House has some contamination with E. coli, so don't eat raw cookie dough for a while. And maybe don't eat raw cookie dough unless you've made it up yourself, would be even a better strategy. This E. coli is a bad one. It could make you quite ill. Another one, this came out from the FDA this week. Please stop using the nasal zinc products. And the FDA particularly pinpointed Zicam brand nasal gel, nasal swabs, and said that there's evidence that these can cause loss of the sense of smell, which can be permanent. We talked about that last year. There have been over 130 reports now of loss of the sense of smell associated with these products. Interestingly enough, the main science for the use of zinc was in zinc lozenges for colds. So there was an extrapolation that if it worked as a lozenge, maybe we should squirt it in our nose, since that's how most of us get cold remedies. And it does dry up the nose, so it was a good symptom reliever. But losing your sense of smell is a high price to pay for not having a case of the sniffles. So do avoid zinc in the nose. And the third one, just for those of you who have small children, and particularly children in diapers, we're running into a large amount of cryptosporidium infections coming from people in swimming pools. Now, what's a large amount? Well, a large amount is 3,726 people in 2007, and that's up from 500 people in 2004. So cryptosporidium is a parasite. Unfortunately, it can live in swimming pools for about 10 days, even when the pools are chlorinated. So, you know, don't poop in the pool, kids. And parents, if you've got a child who isn't reliably not going to poop in the pool, then you really, as a public health measure, should keep them out of public swimming pools. Then your own personal pool at home will be the only one contaminated with cryptosporidium. And that would be good. I mean, it would be good for the rest of us. So I have an off-air question, which I want to take a moment and address. What is your opinion on having a two-tier health insurance premium arrangement? One tier for high-risk people such as smokers or other substance abusers, and a second tier for everyone, which should be cheaper. I think that this is a way of addressing some of the frustration that those people who take care of themselves, stay at an appropriate body weight, exercise, don't smoke, feel about the idea of having a health insurance system where the people who don't do those things and who don't take care of themselves would pay the same premium and would obviously utilize more of the money spent because they would be sicker people. And I think it's better to use honey than vinegar. When you talk about humans, particularly free-range humans, incentives are more effective. So I would probably frame it as a two-tier health insurance premium system that was a base price for everybody, and then a reduced or a rebate for people. And I think I would frame it as a rebate. I think I would take the same money out of everybody's pocket. And then for the people who hit certain healthcare goals, I would give them back money every year to the extent that they hit those goals. And you could frame those goals as you have a BMI of 25 or less, which is the body mass index, which for a 5'6" woman is, it's about 150, 155 pounds is the BMI of 25. So, you know, not hard to achieve if you put a little effort into it. The other parameters you might use would be a certain fitness parameter. You could test blood routinely for cotinine, which will tell you if the person is smoking. And so a negative cotinine level gets you some money back. And that would be really good because, you know, you can't lie about it. Other things that you could use would be a hemoglobin A1C, which is a blood sugar marker. And people who are not diabetic, who have A1C in the low risk zone, would have that because they were eating differently or because they got lucky in the genetics. But either way, their cost to the healthcare system is likely to be lower, and so they should receive a rebate. If it's not your behavior, and it's just that you have really good DNA, then that's okay. You're still going to cost the system less and you still deserve the rebate because that's, you know, we're trying to motivate behavior, but we're also doing it because we want the costs to be low. So, you know, just an off-the-cuff riff on the idea, I think we'll see something like that, but I think it would be a lot smarter to do it as a rebate rather than a penalty. Let's go to Jerry in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jerry. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Much better than a couple days ago. I had a strangest thing happen. I took off my sweatshirt over my head a couple days ago, and that little triangular piece of cartilage on the external ear, I guess it's called the tragus, all of a sudden had this searing pain. They went right through sort of my eustachian tube, and it lasted for a couple minutes and then was completely gone. What was that?
Well, it's a little cartilage. As you say, the tragus is a little piece of cartilage, and you tweaked it, you bent it, and it fired off all of its nerve endings.
Wow.
Hence your searing pain. And it flopped back into place, evidently, because you're not in searing pain anymore. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's what you did. People sometimes will sort of almost dislocate a joint, and when you stretch cartilage or ligament like that, you really feel it, and it can be sore for a couple of days. Hopefully you didn't crack it. That's unlikely. You probably just bent it, and then it flopped back into place.
Wow. It was the strangest sensation.
I bet. Yeah.
And it wasn't like the sweatshirt was very tight or anything like that, and it's such a small little thing there.
You just caught it maybe on the edge of the collar where it doesn't expand very well and snapped it.
Okay.
Just one of those weird things that happen.
Weird. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we'll go to the emails now. This one from Teresa in Santa Cruz. Teresa writes, I am 4 years post-kidney transplant with bilateral nephrectomy. In the past year, I've begun to experience high blood pressure, anemia, headaches, and fatigue. I'm going through a stressful divorce and living alone. My blood pressure is being treated with lisinopril and labetalol. The anemia is being treated with polysaccharide iron. I'm also having depression, which is treated with Zoloft, with less than satisfactory result. I'm writing to ask if taking a supplement triad of antioxidant-rich berry juice, omega-3 fatty acid from wild salmon, and annatto bush seeds, along with a third product derived from the noni plant, could help my situation, or would it be contraindicated if the goal is immune suppression to prevent rejection? I believe that the noni plant formula is intended for vasodilation to enhance blood flow and deliverance of other products to tissues and organs. I would appreciate your opinion. Well, Teresa, let me start by qualifying my opinion to say that whenever you use a combination of products together, there's very little science to support the combination because, you know, when we do science on natural products, we almost always do it in isolated compounds. So at that point, we can't always say that the combination is going to do the same thing as the individual components. Antioxidants, I have no problem with. Omega-3 fatty acids, from whatever source, again, I have no problem with. I'm not familiar with annatto bush seeds. But I want to come back to what I see as the elephant in the room on your commentary here, which is you have hypertension, which can be one of the early signs that the organ is trying to reject. And you're going through a stressful divorce and living alone. You may be socially isolated. You may not have as much support as you need. And I'm more worried about the effects that those stressors have on your immune system function. Particularly, I believe that this could raise the possibility of organ rejection. So I want to encourage you, run, do not walk, to the nearest bookstore and get some visualization tapes. Get some guided meditation or some visualization tapes or CDs, or go online and buy some downloads if you work in that world. But for sure, start working on modulating your stress levels, on getting that relaxation response going every day. And in addition, because you're going through a divorce and you're living alone, there's a lot of need for physical contact. So I would find a way, whether you end up doing it as barter or end up doing it as trade, find a way to get some body work, some massage, at least once a week. The physical closeness, the relaxation of being touched and stroked, it's kind of a return to the womb. A good massage will take away the stressors of a week of difficult life situation. And it's so important right now that you not have your nervous system on alert, because that alert signal to the immune system is what gets the T cells wandering around looking for somebody to attack. And your transplanted organ is a fairly good target. Now, another relaxation technique that might be useful if you can afford it is acupuncture. Acupuncture really has been shown to increase endorphins and enkephalins, which are your body's natural opiates and calming signals, and that can have a great down regulation on your stress. So how you think about things, how you spend time not thinking about things, and how you allow yourself to be touched, either at the energy level through the acupuncture and at the body level through massage. I really want to say that the money spent on these things, I believe, will pay greater benefits than a product, no matter how good the product is. And it may be a very good product. I want to encourage you to work directly with your stress level and your immune system, because I think that's where your greatest vulnerability lies. Let's go to Tim in Santa Cruz. Welcome to the show.
Okay, thank you. I've had a 25-year complex candida fungal problem that essentially it's destroyed my health. But I'll just distill it down to a couple of things, and maybe you could comment. I'm wondering if I'm being too fearful about taking 5 milligrams of hydrocortisone, because of I have severely depleted adrenals, and I'm very fearful about taking it because that sort of thing contributes to fungal infections. So that would be the first thing. And the second thing is biofilms. Do you have any comment or knowledge of biofilms and how they form in the body to protect these bacteria and fungi?
Yes, I have a fair amount of knowledge about both of these things. First of all, I want to make, you know, this is a radio program. I can do like a little bit of Oprah-style confessional. And I was trained to just dismiss any claims of systemic candidiasis as nonsense. You know, that's non-medical. There's no evidence for that. That's what I was taught in medical school. And that's pretty much how I felt about it until roughly about 5 years ago, when I began to encounter literature that reframed the candida. I still need to say that a lot of healthy people have candida, which is a type of yeast, in their stool, or it can be cultured from their rectum, and it will grow out on stools. And these are demonstrably healthy people who have no illness. They have no disease. If you test antibodies by doing a skin test, more than half of the population will react to candida. And some populations, as much as 90% will react to candida under the skin. So we all carry candida antibodies.
Right.
And when you read a book about candida, they tend to conflate, to blend the severe candidiasis that we see in hyperimmune suppressed individuals in a hospital setting.
Right.
Who get, you know, candida growing in their cerebrospinal fluid, or who have blood, you do a blood culture and they grow candida. Now, this is an individual with a collapsed immune system.
Right.
And that's just a completely different situation. I will frame candida problems as being candida is not the problem. Candida is the symptom of the, it's a result of a deeper problem, and it creates problems of its own. But it is it's not the source.
Right.
Okay, the source is deeper in your body, because
we
live in an environment, we all live in an environment that is full of bugs. And we were evolved not to get these bugs growing in our bloodstream. And when they do grow in our intestine, which they can, we have mechanisms that protect our body from these organisms and keep them down to a low level and don't let them overgrow. And, you know, they're essentially a weed. And
like probiotics.
Exactly. Well, probiotics are the start, but it goes back even further than probiotics. It goes back to how your immune system in your intestines gets programmed in the first couple of years of your life.
So
if that programming, for whatever reason, you're a premature baby, your mother can't breastfeed, you have to have antibiotics because you've got an infection that's severe. There's a gazillion things that can go wrong there in that early programming. And there's also genetic components. If you have an atopic background, you're likely to have more problems. So if everybody in mom's side of the family has asthma, you know, you're likely to have problems developing a normal gut immune system ecosystem. And that's going to affect what can grow in you. And then that's going to affect whether there's an environment present that a candida can thrive in.
Sure.
Then you get into things like diet. So really, when people come forward and they say the chronic candidiasis, what they're saying to me is that I have an underlying ecosystem problem that allows all these weeds to grow in my body. Mm-hmm. Well, what can you do with that? Well, you can do weed control measures, and that's where the Candida diet comes from.
Right.
And that does help because there's less substrate for the Candida. You have less of it growing. You can do things that support the immune system. That's where the probiotics come in. I like to think of probiotics as ground cover. Back to the weeds, okay? If you've got a nice ground cover, you're going to get fewer weeds. So the probiotics that we put in our mouths, actually, and this is where we're bringing it around to biofilms, the probiotics that we put in our mouth actually don't survive very long. If you put in certain strains, like you have a particular DNA pattern, you put that in your mouth, and then you measure the poop on the person over the several months, initially, while they're taking the probiotic, you'll be getting it out the other end. And then a month or so after they stop taking that probiotic, it disappears from their stool, so you're no longer getting that particular DNA coming out. However, when you look in the colon and look see what's happened, they've actually developed a different biofilm. This is slime, okay? We all have slime.
Right.
Slime in the toilet, right? That's a biofilm.
Right.
And we all have slime in our intestines, and this slime is optimized for a certain mix of bacteria. So if you start loading up with probiotics, what ends up happening is that you create a biofilm in that intestine that tends to support probiotic organisms. And it will be the ones that naturally colonize you that thrive in that new biofilm.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are incapable of maintaining a high-quality biofilm that promotes probiotics. And those are the individuals that have to keep taking probiotics.
Yeah.
The rest of us can just, like when we go on antibiotics or when we get gastroenteritis and we get an overgrowth of weeds, we can blast with high doses of probiotics. And there's an excellent interview about this in my archives with Dr. Gary Hufnagel, and you can go search the Ask Dr. Don archives for it.
Okay.
But that's kind of the short version. Now, to come back to your question about the hydrocortisone, why are you going to hydrocortisone for adrenal exhaustion? There are other simpler and, I would say, safer measures, particularly for someone who has this ecosystem problem. Has anybody talked to you about using just glandular extracts and using some of the herbs that, you know, there's excellent herbal products that support the adrenal glands? Have you already been there, done that, and it's not worked for you?
No. My doctor, in combination with the cortisol, I do have an adrenal complex herbal thing that I was taking, he's a very holistic type of doctor, you probably know him, but I was concerned about the hydrocortisone. And
I think if you do need the hydrocortisone because you're so down and you've got such a disruption in your natural circadian rhythm that it's just so bad that you have to do this, then I think my recommendation would be on the Candida diet, which essentially means no bread, nothing fermented by yeast, and no citric acid, for example, because citric acid as a food preservative is usually yeast-derived.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So you're looking at a very restricted diet, and you're going to have to walk that path while you're on the cortisone. So if you have to do it, and also I would keep powering the probiotics down all the time that you're doing this.
Yeah. Well, as I say, this is a 25-year adventure, and the diet has been from day one, so just not making any progress. But, yeah, those two points you addressed well, and I appreciate that.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now, I think I should just make a comment here that was a functional medicine discussion, and I couldn't have had that discussion without all of the things I've learned through the Institute for Functional Medicine, through the articles and the scientific research that they've told me existed. Because believe me, the drug rep doesn't come by and drop this article about how diet affects Candida or what biofilms are and how we can manipulate them to help people with asthma. I don't get those articles from the pharmaceutical reps. They don't show up very often in the New England Journal of Medicine or the American Family Practice Journal, which are the journals I read. I have to go after them, and in order to go after them, I have to know they're there. So I want to just put in a plug for functional medicine and the functionalmedicine.org site, and we have a link on our website, is just a wealth of good information for doctors and other healthcare professionals who are dealing with these complex chronic diseases that, you know, the drugs just don't work that well. So I want to say, have a great day. I want to say, stay healthy. And I want to urge you to come back next week, listen to more of the program, maybe check out the interview archives, and maybe shoot me an email at askdrdon.com. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy. It's a beautiful day. Take a walk.